We'll call the meeting to order, and I know I had talked to Mary Dent about just giving a little information here at the beginning of the meeting. So, Mary, why don't you just come down and give us a quick little introduction to your program, what you're concerned about, and go ahead and sit at the table. I hope you guys don't mind.
I can just stand up here. Thank you.
Okay.
My name is Mary Benz. I'm the Associate Dean in the College of Education and Human Development.
Mary, you can take a seat right there.
Okay.
Andrew's got a chair for you.
Thank you. The Associate Dean in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota, and I'm here as the President of MACD, the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. We represent all of the higher education institutions that are approved by the Board of Teaching to prepare teachers in Minnesota, and we are having our first and hopefully not last, day on the Hill to come to visit with you, the committee members that are affiliated with education, and also with individual representatives here today. So we are around, and we are just here to let you know that we are available to help you find information and to provide support for education in Minnesota. So, thank you, and I just have a couple of brochures that I will pass on here, and just to let you know that we're here today.
And
thank
Andrews
you.
And Andrews and Nina will do that, and I just, a quick question, I mean, your group is the group that educates our educators, and...
That's right.
And, I'm wondering, are you nervous about the, you know, the fact that perhaps we're not educating enough teachers, that they're... The system is not prepared for, I think, probably the retirements that might be happening because of our age group, you know, getting ready to, baby boomers getting ready to call it quits and retire. Are you nervous about that at all, or are you thinking everything's okay?
Well, actually, I think we are preparing a new crew of educators for our schools, people that are coming prepared to work with children from very diverse backgrounds. I do think that it is very important that we attend to induction and support of teachers who are in the ranks of teaching and to help them to stay in the profession longer. There are several bills that have been introduced and are in at various levels in the committees here having to do with induction, which is support of first, second, and third year teachers, having to do with recruitment of persons of color into the teaching profession, support for National Board for Professional Teaching Standards. There are several things like that that will support the people who are in the schools. Right now, I don't have, I'm not particularly concerned about the number of teachers that we're preparing. I am concerned that we have high quality teachers in our schools.
Okay, any questions? Thank you very much, then.
Thank you for your time.
I appreciate you coming in front of the committee. And good luck with your first day on the Hill.
Thank you.
Then our first bill up today, Representative Hill, House File 358. Representative Slocum moves House File 358 for possible inclusion in the omnibus Higher Education and Workforce Development bill. Representative Hill, welcome, and your witnesses to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Riccovina. I have the 358A1 amendment to adopt to get the bill into shape that we need to have it in. It has a bit of a technical correction in it. The amendment should be before you.
Slocum would move then the A1 amendment. Do I have a quorum here yet? That's been before. Okay. We'll just wait and we'll adopt the amendment when we get a quorum. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair Riccovina, members. The bill's about Cook County. Cook County, members, is up in Grand Marais, up in the very tip of the Arrowhead, probably about as far away as you can get from St. Paul in this state. And we have before us today as a witness, Paula Sundet, who will explain what Cook County Higher Education does and what they use the money for and what their programs are. So, welcome. If you introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
And I'm Paula Sundet. I'm the director of Cook County Higher Education. I appreciate very much having an opportunity to come here today to talk about Cook County Higher Education and our need for the additional $40,000 per year for funding for Cook County Higher Education. We've been operating for 10 years. This is our 11th year. And we started with federal funding and have worked with some grant money as well. And we received funding from the state in 2000. And so we've very much, it's been important for us. The success has been phenomenal. Our growth rate this last year was 112%, which is quite significant growth, mostly because we're concentrating on business training in the community. That's been a new effort for us. As Representative Bill mentioned, we're a long ways away from the nearest college or university. It's an average of 125 miles for our residents, and that's a long ways to travel for driving. So Cook County Higher Education provides an opportunity for people to obtain their degree, their training in Grand Marais without having to leave the community, and they can stay and work there. As you know, people who, where they obtain their education is frequently where they work. So if we can keep our folks in the community, that's going to make a big difference. And we need the additional money. The request is so that we can expand some of the programming that we're currently doing. For instance, this year we have 20 people to enroll in our RN program. That's a phenomenal increase for us. Last year we had 5. So the need is there. We also need healthcare professionals desperately. And we don't have the facilities to provide that kind of training. So we need an additional room for the interactive television to be set up and additional space to have that many students in one room. And we're also, again, as I mentioned, we're increasing some of the business training, for instance, the real estate program and real estate continuing education. And some of those actually do provide us with revenue. And in general, as a nonprofit organization, we don't bring in much money. We're usually requesting money as far as grants. But this is one that is actually self-supporting, and we want to increase that to reduce our need. And I don't know if you've got some specific questions or if there's something in addition you'd like me to add.
Before Representative Slocum moves the A1 amendment, is there any discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Representative Bryant, did you have discussion on the amendment?
Well, the amendment is substantially is just indicating where the money's coming from, right? So that's not, I don't know if it's my discussions on the amendment or the motion or the bill. So
yeah, the
you
amendment,
tell me.
The amendment just puts the, it's a courtesy we usually do to the author to put his bill in the condition he wants it in.
All
those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dill, we have an institution of higher education in the city I live in. It's called Presentation College in the Southern Minnesota Education Campus. It's privatized the city of Fairmont. Spent $1,700,000 refurbishing my old elementary school, so you know it's an old building. What do you do with this institution? Is it all interactive learning, or what is it?
Representative Gunther, I'll have his son to answer that. They have quite an intricate curriculum, so I'll let her answer that question.
Ms. Sundet, go ahead.
Thank you. Sorry, Chairman Rubina. Representative Gunther, we offer various different types of programming based on individual requests. So some people are working on correspondence courses. Some people are taking online programs. What we offer are interactive television classes, and we also work with the regional colleges and universities to provide programming with live instructors. We use our very well-educated retired population to serve as instructors and also as mentors. We, in essence, we're brokering programs that the colleges and universities in the area have, and we see that they're provided in Cook County. So we're working significantly with Hibbing Community College, Vermilion Community College, Mesabi Range, and Fond du Lac and Lake Superior College. That's the primary ones that we're working with. And we're also forging relationships with the University of Minnesota and others.
Representative Gaffney.
Thank you. You offer associate arts degrees and things like that through your institution?
Well, it's offered through the accredited institutions. We're merely the vehicle for it to happen. We're not accredited in and of ourselves.
Okay. Thank you. It's very much like what we have down there.
I'd be interested in hearing more about what you have.
I'll get to some information. Representative Dill.
Okay. Any other testimony? Any questions? Representative Dill.
Representative Hill, I just want to say that this is a really great program in Cook County, and I personally know about it. My summer home is in Cook County, so I'm a part-time resident. But I have heard from people that live up there who have taken advantage of the program what a great program it is. And it's really delivering education to an area that's it's hard to get to the nearest college. So it's delivering education and job retoolment to people who may not get it any other way. It's a good program.
Well, maybe we can take a tour this summer and we can stay at your cabin.
There you go.
There you go.
We'll be there. I recommend that the freshman legislators sell their cabin because we're just going to keep them so busy down here.
Yeah.
There you go.
Not in this lifetime.
So Representative Gavina.
Representative Dale, closing statement.
Well, this for those of you, I think that everyone knows where Cook County is. Every legislator writes it's this county, that county, and other counties. But, you know, we're talking Lucent, Toffee, Schroeder, up the shore, up the North Shore, beyond Silver Bay, all the way up to the end of Grand Portage Indian Reservation, all the way up to the end of the Gunflint Trail, up on the Canadian border. And, you know, if you can imagine, if you've driven up in that part of the country, driving up Highway 61, which is really the only access into Cook County from this area, and imagine having to drive to Duluth to go to the nearest higher educational institution, this is a huge bridge that they have built, and at a very, very low expense in terms of if you added up commuter miles, gasoline, hours of commuting. I mean, a college education might cost several hundred thousand dollars to acquire, where this is a helpful hedge against those kinds of expenses. And I'd really encourage the chairman to look favorably towards this bill. But that's unless my Paula, you have anything else?
I believe so. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Representative, did you have one more question?
Yeah, I just got a statement. You know, your school and the school I have in my district are both very near to a foreign country. We're next to Iowa.
Okay, with that then, Representative Slocum renews her motion that House File 358 be, as amended, be move for possible inclusion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Fritz, House Bill 118.
Chair. Can I move?
Representative Mahoney moves that House Bill 118 be recommended to pass and be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Fritz. It's always an extreme pleasure.
Thank you, Representative Chairman Brookavina, and members. Thank you for taking up our bill, House File 118, today. We have a couple of storyboards that we'd like you to take a look at. I have with me from Faribault, Minnesota, Matt Drevlow, who will be our testifier. Matt is the director of the Paradise Center for the Arts, and I recognize some of the members here heard this presentation last year, so we're back again. And but
good, then we can make it real quick.
Oh. Do we need to move the bill, or is it...
It's already been moved.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Chairman Rukovina and members, the Paradise Center for the Arts is located in downtown Faribault. I like to say that I live in the perfect place. It's right down, straight down on Highway 35. You turn off and go into town. It's a historic downtown, deemed a historic downtown area in the state of Minnesota, and we're very proud of the downtown. However, it's like most downtowns in greater Minnesota, we're struggling. We have the Paradise Center for the Arts, which is the old movie theater. Beautiful facility. And we've been working on that for a long time, trying to bring that up to a Paradise for, Center for the Arts. And I'll just read to you the mission statement, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Drevlow. The mission statement is that the Paradise Center for the Arts endeavors to create a vivid, energetic cultural center for the community and region, as well as to be an integral part of the downtown. By offering high-quality visual and performing arts opportunities, we enhance the quality of life for artists, art lovers, throughout the region and beyond. We're asking you today to help us get a handicapped elevator. The amount of that is $151,000. The shaft is in. We've done a great deal of work. But we do have a large population of handicapped folks in the area who would not only like to come to view a play, but also to be able to participate in the play on the stage. So we're hoping that you'll be kind to us and give us some money for that handicapped elevator. Thank you. And I'll turn it over to Matt Drevlo.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. Mr. Drevlo, you can proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to speak today. The Paradise Center for the Arts is an organization that started as a collaborative effort of the Faribault Arts Center and the Faribault Area Community Theater, as well as the Merlin Players Theater Group. The Faribault Arts Center has been in existence since about 1965 and has been providing arts education in the community of Faribault for all that time. Recently, we have moved more into the area of doing a lot of educational programming for children as well as for senior citizens. One of the programs I'm most proud of is that we've worked cooperatively with Rice County Social Services to work with some of the children that are pulled out of the school and put into specialized programming because either disciplinary problems or other issues. We bring them in into a program that we call Business of Arts, and what we do is we give them a project that they're going to create, and then we create a venue for them to sell that project, and they're given incentive rewards as they move forward with the project and create the project, and when they're done with it, they are tasked with putting together a marketing plan and then using that marketing plan to sell the product to give them some real life skills and some real job skills. I think it's very beneficial for these kids, and it's one of the programs I'm the most proud of that we've been doing. We've been operating up until now out of a small lease space on Central Avenue, but we recently, actually 2 years ago, started working on the project of moving into the old Paradise Theater and converting it into a multi-purpose center for the arts. Part of that process was taking a theater that was built in 1929 and built out of solid concrete and brick and converting it over to youth that was handicap accessible, a little more accessible for a lot of the elderly population we have within the community of Faribault. You can see from the storyboard there, from the floor plan, that we have provided for a large gallery space and gift shop in the main lobby area of the facility. That gallery space we will focus on providing a venue for Minnesota artists to display their work in a regional setting. And we have a rotating show that comes in there. One artist will set up for a month. The show will then be on display and for sale and then be taken down at the end of the month, and another artist will be brought in, and thus throughout the year, as well as the gift shop located in the front. It's kind of a misnomer to call it a gift shop. It's actually what I would call a retail gallery, and that gallery is meant to be a space for local artists and artisans to be able to display the work that they've created, as long as it's original work, and have that work on sale and give them a venue for the sale of that art. I'm very proud of the fact that as we've worked in this project, we've worked very close in hand with the City of Faribault. The City of Faribault has also stepped forward and provided some funding for this project and is using it as a centerpiece of their efforts to redevelop downtown Faribault. It's helped in the last 2 years. We've seen two new restaurants now be moved into downtown Faribault, and I think that the excitement of the Paradise Center for the Arts has had some bearing on that. We, despite the not getting the financing for the elevator that we requested last year, we had to move forward with the project to continue moving forward, so we borrowed the money to put the elevator shaft in and then simply sheetrocked over the doors so we can continue to move forward with the project. As of next week, we will have if you look at the floor plan, we will have the gift shop, lobby, first floor classroom, work copy area, concession area, men's restroom, which will be used as a unisex restroom for the time being, and the gallery available for public use. But we will not be able to move upstairs until that elevator is provided due to code compliance issues, and we cannot occupy that upstairs space until the elevator is put in. So we've raised $1 million from the local community, and we've put in countless hours of volunteer work, and we've also received a big benefit by using the prisoners from the local state penitentiary to do almost all of our demolition work at a savings of about $75,000. But at this point, there's only so much that volunteers can do, and unfortunately, as much as I would like them to be able to do it, volunteers cannot build an elevator, and I don't know that I would necessarily want to ride in an elevator that a volunteer built, because sometimes you get what you paid for. So at this point, we're really kind of at an impasse. We need to get that elevator in so that we can complete the remainder of the upstairs. Once that's in, we have some concrete to pour and some walls to build, but those are things, once again, that the volunteers can help us with and we can recognize some cost savings on. So we really are looking for some help with this elevator. Also, like Patty mentioned in the beginning, it's not simply an elevator so that people can have access to the space and see the space, but also so that people, if you look at the plans carefully, there's also included in the request for funds is a lift so that handicapped individuals can actually have access to the stage as well. So the stage itself will also be handicapped accessible, which is something that a lot of these older auditoriums are not. and it was something that was very important to us to provide full handicap accessibility to the stage so that the people can also, beyond just having handicapped people be able to view performances, they'll also be able to participate in performances in a meaningful fashion. That's all I have, unless anyone has any other questions about the bill.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. Does the city own the theater? Because I see that because the grant you're asking for is to the city of Faribault.
We're asking the grant. The city does not own the facility. The facility is owned by a nonprofit organization, but we're asking the grant go to the city so they would administer the funds to ensure that the funds went towards the provision of the elevator and the lift system and the handicap accessibility requirements that we are requesting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if that has been done before. I mean, it's a little unusual to give the grant to the city when it's really a private entity.
And this is...
Representative Ruth, I think it's we've done that many times that I can think of in the past before where we use a city or local unit of government as the fiscal agent for something that's, you know, a non-profit.
And then one more.
Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And then the other question... $551,000 doesn't seem like a lot, and you've already raised $1 million. I'm just curious for the amount and why that can't be raised as well.
Mr. Drebin?
The reason is that Faribault is a decent-sized community of 20,000, but, I mean, it took years of work to get $1 million out of the community, and our commitment to the community was that we were going to try, if they would step forward and pay for half the project, they were going to go to other sources and try and obtain the remainder of the funds so we could finish the facility. We're also in the process of requesting grants from other organizations and working on that as well. As many of you know, the McKnight Foundation is a large grant organization within the community. We are meeting with them on a large grant request we've done with them. We've also requested funds from the Mardag Foundation and a number of other foundations. But we felt like that since this has a bearing on the economic development of downtown, also because of the educational program we provide, that it was appropriate that we come up and at least request some state funding for a portion of the fund. And I really do feel that we have made every effort to do as much of the project by ourselves, and the amount of volunteer hours that have been put in has simply been incredible. And I just think that the total build project is a $2.1 million build, and we're asking for $150,000 of that from the state. It's not like we're coming to the state and asking for half or more than that.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Drebin, I appreciate the value that this project is to the community. I really hear what you're saying about what you've contributed. What I'm wondering about is whether federal funds have been sought out or would be appropriate for handicap accessibility.
Federal funds are a double-edged sword. Federal funds come with a lot more regulation than they're really worth sometimes. When you go that route with federal funds, the requirements, the heightened requirements for the other handicap accessibility things that we'd have to provide that may not actually be necessary, sometimes outweigh the benefit of getting the funds from the federal government. And that's a judgment we've made. We also looked at the possibility of getting federal funds for doing some historic preservation for the facility. But the problem you run into there is most federal programs for historic preservation require you to go exactly back to the original with the facility. And that would have meant we would have had a 915-seat auditorium with a very small lobby, which would not have fit the needs of Faribault at all.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fritz, as you all know, I have a special attachment to that facility. I've attended that Paradise Theater many times growing up in Faribault. It's nice to know that the community is going to be renovating that into something that can be used for the community. I do have a question. Has this type of funds been requested for other facilities before similar to this?
I believe so. I think Representative Gunther could speak to that.
Well, Representative Gunther probably can give us a little history. I think I've been around here 20 years, Representative Detmer, and I've seen a lot of bills like this before. This probably would be a good prospect for a bonding bill other than the fact that it's not a local, it's got to be government-owned for that. And that's why it's being run through deed, and there's many requests a year that come in. You'll see a few of mine. Representative Hodge.
Took care of one of the questions. My question was, why is this coming through here and not in the bonding process? But I think you just answered that. Also, I think the federal the federal program that probably has the least strings on is the Community Development Block Grant Program. And those are run by the city and by the county, and they are pretty friendly towards these types of projects. That's what they're there for, and I would also compliment you on the project. That's a lot of money to raise.
And we are...
Go ahead.
We have worked with the community, with the city director of development, with the block grants that are available. Right now, at this time in Faribault, the only block grants that are available that as true grants as opposed to low-interest loans are ones for facade repair in the Faribault district. And I shouldn't say unfortunately. Fortunately, the facade of this facility is in fairly good shape. The only thing that's missing is the marquee. So,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoff.
I would argue that point with him. I think that's a local policy, and I don't think the federal government, I don't think he's quoting you properly on the federal government. The Community Development Block Grant should be able to do this because of its handicap accessibility. And
I think you're
if
right.
If he's saying he's doing facades, I would say that's facade and ask him where it is in the text. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney then renews his motion that House File 118 be recommended passed and held over for possible inclusion. If there are no further questions, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Representative Fritz. Representative Solberg, I believe. Representative Solberg, welcome to the committee. And Representative Moe moves that House File 461 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Solberg, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for hearing House File 461. And Representative Gunther, thank you for hearing the House File similar to this a couple of years ago and a couple of years before that. This has been a long road. House File 461 tries to do the last little bit of financing for the Garland, Judy Garland Children's Museum in Grand Rapids. It's located next to the Judy Garland Museum. And if anybody knows where the ruby slippers are, we would like to know. You got them?
Swearing them last week.
I saw Representative Oz wearing them in his office. He clicked his heels together twice, and he turned into something you don't even want to know about. But anyway,
it wasn't pretty, I'll say.
But, Mr. Chairman, members, in all seriousness, the request has been over the years for the $300,000 that was kind of a state match. And Representative Gunther was kind enough to give us a couple hundred thousand a few years ago. It got vetoed by the governor of Ventura at the time. We were able to obtain $100,000 a couple years ago as well. That was okay. And so the request here is for the last $200,000 of the kind of state obligation. The $300,000 was vetoed one time as well. So I'm persistent enough to try to make sure that we get that. I have with me John Kelch, who's the executive director of the Children's Museum and the Judy Garland Museum as well. And he can talk a little bit about their program up there at the Children's Museum.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kelch. Just to identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm John Kelch, and I have Doug and John Miner, our president and vice president, here with me. Our 10-county area generally does not have, kids in our area don't have access to extended learning programs commonly found in the metro area. We want to give these kids the very best that a children's museum can offer. The Children's Museum in Grand Rapids is clearly a project of regional significance. We're the only children's museum north of St. Paul from western Wisconsin to the North Dakota border. Over the last several years, our interactive school programs have been used by 146 different schools from 65 different Northland communities. I hope you can take a minute to look at the handout of the 146 schools. I wish you could see how excited these kids are when they step off the bus from all points north and south, east and west, for a day of fun learning enrichment here at our museum. They arrive year after year from 45 school districts in the 10 counties of Aiken, Beltrami, Carlton, Cass, Clearwater, Crow Wing, Hubbard, Itasca, Coochiching, and St. Louis. We've enrolled 28,000 children just from schools over this period, and the key teachers give our program high praise. This is the request, as Representative Solberg mentioned, for the last funding piece in our capital campaign. We've built assets worth $2.5 million in the last 10 years. That includes the land on Highway 169, the new Children's Discovery Museum building, the Judy Garland Historic House, and priceless collections. Now, if approved, our project will still be funded almost three-quarters through private funding. And I want to thank you for considering our request, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions for the author or Mr. Kelch? If not, then Representative Moe. Excuse me, I forgot who made that motion. Representative Moe renews his motion, and that House Bill 461 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Any questions? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed. The motion prevails. Representative Solberg, we trust that you will give our committee enough money to
I knew
fund.
That was coming. Well, Mr. Chair, I can
you don't have to
you,
respond
you get 200,000.
Well, good. We just spent it on Dill and Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Solberg, if I had you, I would have funded you 100%.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much for your courtesy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Seifert is not in the room. Representative Mahoney is gone. Representative Mahoney, Mr. Nelson or Ms. Would one of you want to come? Now, Representative Mahoney, let's take up your bill. Representative Mahoney, House File Number 648. Welcome to the committee. Representative Mahoney moves that House File 648 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the finance, to Representative Murphy's committee, which is called what now?
Education Finance, Mr. Chairman.
And something else. And economic competitiveness. There you go. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I hope I'm going to bat 100% today. I had a 200-page bill earlier today. I'm going to go for 100. It's only half as long. This is the annual or the unemployment insurance bill. I would try to explain it, but we have a fellow sitting next to me that has lived this bill for the last year, and I'll let him explain it. It is a compromise bill. A couple things are going to happen in it, and hopefully we'll get it through here.
Mr.
Nelson,
Chairman, members of the committee, I would first off like to point out that this bill passed the Senate last year, 62-0. It passed all appropriate House committees unanimously, got hung up on the House floor last year for reasons unrelated to the bill itself. Last year, the bill was sponsored by Representative Gunther. And now is this year carried by Representative Mahoney. But this bill has the support of the State Chamber of Commerce, the National Federation of Independent Business, the Retail Merchants Association, the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, Jobs Now Coalition, and Legal Aid, and other groups. We've worked on this bill for a number of years, and coming forward again today. Like I say, it is, as Representative Mahoney indicated, a compromise bill, so it has some various trade-offs so that all the interest groups would be on board with this bill. I want to explain just a few of the primary portions of this bill. I should point out that while it's very lengthy, the first 30 pages encompass policy changes. The remainder of the bill are simply housekeeping. Or style and language changes. The last 60 pages, revisers suggested style changes, getting rid of the offending shalls and a few of those kinds of things. As to the first 30 pages, a couple of the primary things that we would like to do, we'd like to provide an alternate base period whereby new labor market entrants would be able to qualify for benefits right away. Currently, if you apply for benefits, the last quarter in which you worked is not counted or considered. Well, a number of people have worked only the last 6 months, and they wouldn't qualify until they would have to wait a period of time to be unemployed until in a quarter change, and then they would qualify. We would like to say if you don't qualify under the current four-quarter period we look at, we'll look at the most recent four quarters, picking up your most recent work. This would add about 2,400 people would qualify for benefits who do not now. They have worked long enough, but they simply haven't worked in the right time period in which to qualify for benefits. This bill also would change the appeal periods from 30 calendar days to 20 calendar days. What we have found is that applicants for benefits appeal right away, for the most part. Employers have a tendency to wait until the last minute. Well, what we would like to do is shorten that appeal period, and what that means is employers would then have to appeal a little sooner, and if we determine that people should be cut off from benefits, they would be cut off 10 days sooner. They shouldn't be receiving these benefits. We believe this will result in $750,000 a year in less in overpayments than now, and people who are overpaid have required to repay that. But in addition to that part of the bill, this bill does require that every determination which is appealable state the exact day and date that it will become final, meaning it says this determination will become final on Tuesday, March 14th, or whatever day it may be. Currently, it just says 30 calendar days, and a number of people have difficulty in understanding that January has 31 days, and they make mistakes, so we want to make it very clear. And that was kind of a trade-off for this, but we believe there will be some savings by shortening the appeal period, but it will have little impact on applicants who appeal, because, again, they appeal right away. The primary thing that this bill does and the biggest impact it has on individuals actually is we would like to change the deduction for working part-time while requesting unemployment benefits. Currently, is very you disallow the first $50, but it's 100% offset after that. So after you work a few hours, you're better off not working at all. You lose money by working. We would like to change that, to remove that disincentive, to make it a straight 55% of your earnings are deducted. So there's an incentive to keep working while requesting benefits. We believe this will positively impact 20,000 people a year who are requesting benefits. As I indicated, this bill...
Mr. Nelson, is there cost savings to the fund that we've had?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to get to why it says we have a consensus of all the groups. Yes, there is an offsetting provision, both that alternate base period of which I spoke and the this earnings deductibility would increase benefit payouts. Correspondingly, to offset that cost, because of the administration's position that an unemployment insurance bill advanced by the administration which should be relatively cost neutral, because a benefit increase is a tax increase ultimately because somebody has to pay the bill. This bill would freeze benefits for certain people. People whose weekly benefit amount is based on a high quarter, which is in aberration to the rest of the quarters they worked in the year. Meaning one single quarter has a high amount because they worked some overtime, they got a bonus, they maybe had a small second job in that quarter. So all of a sudden their weekly benefit amount, which is computed in certain instances only on that high quarter, is kind of an aberration in relation to their overall annual wage. And so we would like to simply cap that. Most people are not affected by that, and again, it would only be those people who weekly benefit amount, because we calculate it two ways, comes out high in relation to their annual wage. And that would offset the cost of the other provisions, giving the bill relatively cost neutral overall. This bill does increase penalties for individuals who commit unemployment insurance fraud. Primary way applicants commit unemployment insurance fraud is working while collecting benefits and not notifying the department. In effect, what they do is say they are not working and they have no earnings when in fact we do cross matches with Social Security, we do cross matches with our own records. Those are all, of course, there's a delay in the time period. But this bill will increase the penalties from a current 25% of the amount fraudulently obtained up to 40% of the amount fraudulently obtained. I do want to mention this is felony level activity when you're doing this unemployment insurance fraud. So we would like to increase the administrative penalties on that. Those are the primary changes. I can go into much more detail if the chair would prefer. But those are the primary changes in this bill.
My libertarian speak in me always comes out when I hear about penalties and that. So, I mean, is it, let's say, if a waitress loses her job because of a smoking ban, we'll say, and then she and she or he is making, you know, a couple $100 a week, is, and they go and get another job, is their fine the same as an unemployed pro football player?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Is it gauged? If there's some fraud there and she or he doesn't report it, then they're making like $100 a week. Is that felony, as you alluded to? Is that
Mr. Chairman,
same fine as somebody that maybe getting $1,000 a week?
Mr. Chairman, no. Again, the amount of the administrative penalty is a percentage of the amount that you fraudulently obtain. If the waitress fraudulently obtained $10,000 worth of unemployment benefits, they would have the same penalty as a pro football player who obtained $10,000 fraudulently. A pro football player would not normally qualify, but that's another issue.
I brought it up because I remember we had an issue with professional sports, the best. Okay. I was curious.
Mr. Chairman, when an individual commits unemployment insurance fraud, they are asked the question, did you work? And they would respond no, when in fact they were working. And they are asked, did you have any earnings during this week? And they would respond no, when in fact they have earnings. Then they are asked, before any determination is made, they are asked to explain if they can show that they didn't understand the questions or those types of things. There are cases in which I must say, pretty clear cut. They knew what was going on.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't found it in the bill yet, but the bill talks about making compensation for National Guard and the military employment. Could you explain that a little bit?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, I didn't go into that because of the relatively small thing as far as the number of individuals who would be impacted. This bill does provide that there is no deduction for military earnings while you're collecting unemployment benefits. And this would be a situation as in a reserve unit who may report for duty once a month, let's say, for a weekend. And while they're unemployed and collecting benefits, current law would provide an offset for some of those military earnings. And this bill would provide no offset at all for any earnings for an individual in the military, meaning it's usually those people reserve working on weekends. And but we believe this will impact, I think our figures showed 180 people back in like 05. So that's why I didn't mention it earlier. It is not because I didn't want to get into it. Impacts a relatively small amount of people, but it is a very big impact for those individuals.
Okay, Mr. Chair. And that is a good thing. What it also includes, say that soldier that's on annual training for 2 weeks.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Duffner, yes, it could. I can into detail if you want to explain how it might. Under current law, if you're actually working more than 32 hours a week, you cannot collect unemployment benefits. But if you're working less than 32 hours, then it's a question of how much money are you earning. And so if they were, did this service less than 32 hours in a week and in fact had earnings of a certain level, there would be no deduction for those earnings. And so this will positively impact, as I said, about 180 people a year would receive more in unemployment benefits than they do now. No one would receive less under the provision regarding the military.
Thank you.
I would like to just temporarily this bill over. Representative Seifert has people that have come up from his district that I'd like to. Is that okay, Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, I serve to make. I just am here trying to make you happy.
Thank you. We'll temporarily House File 648 over House File 519, Representative Seifert. Am I, there's Seifert, Seifert, Eifert, Eufert. Representative Seifert, am I mispronouncing your name when I say Seifert, or should I say Seifert?
I've been called a lot worse, Mr. Chair.
By me, too.
It's Seifert is preferential, but...
Okay. Not today, though. Representative Seifert, Representative Detmer moves that House File 519 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Workforce Development Bill. Welcome to the committee. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, this bill is basically a supplement to what is in the deed base budget is $60,000. Representative Gunther chaired the committee. This program, the Minnesota Inventors Congress, had bipartisan support. It happens to be headquartered in my district. And this proposal will be for $85,000, so the difference is $25,000, and I'll let the committee decide if the merits are there. There is an outline that is in there on where the budget would go to. This is a program that's been around for 50 years, Mr. Chairman, something I attended when I was growing up in Redwood County, that has resulted in a lot of interesting products that have been brought forward in the state of Minnesota. We have a lot of people that got their start right with our organization down in Redwood Falls. Deb Hess, who is our director down there, will give us some, I think, a couple examples of some things. We also have things that aren't necessarily inventions, but they are what I would say building on current products. We have a car manufacturer in Redwood Falls, the Prinzing Car Factory. They make the only four-door convertible in the United States in Redwood Falls. I don't know if people even know that we have a car manufacturer in Minnesota other than the Ford plant in St. Paul. But the Prinzen Company makes custom-made hearses, and they also make deluxe convertibles. And I think the average price, what would it be on a Prinzen car?
It's about $95,000.
About $95,000 for a car that's made in Redwood Falls. Maybe the chairman would like a ride in one if we could arrange a visit there.
Chairman would like to be able to afford one.
And it is an interest. If the committee would ever like to visit this, it is really interesting. It's right on Bridge Street in Redwood Falls. The Prinzing Company, my understanding, was bought out by the Lower Sioux Reservation, has purchased the car company now, but it is really a neat thing. We have celebrities from around the country that have purchased Prinzing cars. Boats, the original Bean Rider, and some of the extra things that have gone with that were all things from the Inventors Congress. The wheelchair brake is what we demonstrated last year, Mr. Chair. I'm going to turn it over to Deb Hess, just give an idea of what they do in summary, and also give a couple examples of some inventions that have come out of our Minnesota Inventors Congress.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. I know you've come a long way, and I really appreciate that. That's what I wanted to make sure. But can you... be quick because we've got that other major bill to get on.
We have this down, Mr. Chair, to a very quick time. My name is Deb Hess, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Inventors Congress. I would like to make it as efficient as possible. The way we have it scheduled is for Julie Rath, one of my bosses, to do some of the introduction pieces, and then I'll do the fun pieces and tell you the stories about some of the inventors I work with on a regular basis.
Go ahead.
We'll keep it moving. I am Julie Rath. I serve as on the board of directors for the MIC. And this coming year, we're just kicking off our 50th anniversary. So it'll be the 50th year for the expo to be held in Redwood Falls. And we want to thank the support of the legislature through the years for helping us put on this event. We appreciate your time today, and as we share a few of our success stories and explain to you how we've used your money from our current grants and how we intend to use the increase in funding we're requesting today.
By providing our juvenile resource center, we have one full-time staff person in the office in 2006, and we have served 1,989 adventurers this past year. The office is in direct contact with over 3,400 people that have made inquiries through the office, and to date, in this fiscal year, we have served 1,203 adventurers and made contact with over 2,600 businesses, organizations, and students. And the busy months are just approaching. Our show is held in June, so March, April, and May are when we have our largest number of inquiries and contacts to the office. Deb, as our executive director, spends as much time as possible and energy presenting to different organizations across the state of Minnesota and in North and South Dakota. And the most important message that we deliver to audiences is the importance for the inventor being knowledgeable about the product development process before they spend time and money with the wrong type of company. Finding out if there is a market for a product is very important in developing stages, and the annual expo is a great way for the inventor to test their market and their new idea. It also helps formulate the information about whether to move ahead with their next steps. And Deb now will give you a few examples of some of the inventions that were at the show.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
How many of you were here 2 years ago when Jerry Ford had his wheelchair and did the demonstration and showed you? So there's just a couple. Okay. Well, Jerry Ford was here from St. Charles, Minnesota, and he showcased his invention. It's a braking system for wheelchairs. After exhibiting at our event in 2004, he went into business and is now manufacturing the product line in St. Charles. He specifically wanted me to share with you that he is still in business, that he has products in 40 states, and is developing a larger dealer distribution where he now has dealers in 9 different states selling his wheelchairs. And this system is a device that if you sit in it, the braking system releases, but if you stand up and it locks, it's an automatic braking system. There's an incline brake for the operator to be able to stop the wheelchair if it's going down the hill too fast, and then there's a hand braking system as well for the operator, where typically only the person in the chair has access, or you have to bend over and do all the work for the braking. He is a preferred provider for the 260 Good Samaritan homes across the country, and he's finding very unique ways to deal with some of the larger corporations and working with the dealers instead of having to get those systems the way that the bigger companies do. But he clearly wanted you to know how important the MIC played in the development of his company, and he claims that it's all because of the MIC, that the public feedback he received at the event gave him the encouragement and the evidence that he needed to prove that he had something worth pursuing. And that invention came from his son, who worked in one of the in the veterans home in Laverne, and or not in Laverne. He's in St. Charles, outside of Rochester. Anyway, his son worked at a nursing home and is now actually working for the company, but he wanted something to help because of the number of falls that he was having, and he was literally driving in his tractor and came up with this idea, went to work in his shop and created this invention, called our organization, he received information on how to do the steps and pursued it. Another inventor that exhibited in 1995, this is a fun story, he invented a utilipole, which is a telescoping pole to hang bird feeders from. They sell for $54.95. He sold 10,000 of them, which is a $550,000 income into the state of Minnesota. And the majority of them, he said the vast majority of them were sold in Minnesota, which generated about $35,000 in sales tax. That was in 1995. He exhibited. He stopped in the office in December to visit with me because he has a new idea. He forgot all of the steps that he went through in 1995 to pursue all this through the office. I needed a refresher course, so we went through the steps and gave him the information that we have in our toolkit. And he shared with me that the fun part of this was not only did he generate that kind of revenue, he also sold the company and the patent, and it's still being manufactured and still being distributed across the country by a Minnesota company. So it was another example. And a Nevada inventor contacted us the other day, who has come many times to distribute at our show or exhibit at our show, and he was visiting with me, and I asked him to update me on one of his inventions. And he invented an emergency life blanket, and that was following a tragic accident for a dear friend of his. The invention and its company is now being purchased by another company, and their initial test order of 500,000 of the product uses a 3M reflective material that sells for $8 a yard. That order is a $4 million sale, and it's just the testing phase of this development project. So it's another Minnesota connection on how these relationships get built by the networking we have across the country. Border Buddy, we have passed this one around. That's the wallpaper buddy, yep. Ken Schmidt from Anoka, Minnesota exhibited last year at our 2006 show. He has taken his idea, and in less than 1 year, he's already got his product on the market and is for sale online in his stores. And he was explaining his story to the Inventors Network meeting a couple weeks ago at the Van Dusen Center. And he talked about how he is using a Minnesota company to produce the product. He's using a Minnesota company to make the packaging. They did the video. They are a Minnesota company has done his website development. And he has done all of this in less than a year, which is not the normal. I deal with inventors. Sometimes their product has taken them 11 years to get to a marketable stage because of all of the testing and research they've had to do. But Ken Schmidt clearly is using the toolkit. We have a toolkit that people can download online, and it walks through the product development process from starting with your inventor's notebook. Most inventors think they need to get their patent right away. Well, you need to find out if you're going to make any money with your idea before you invest $3,500 to $15,000 on a patent. So what I do is help educate inventors about this process and take them through the stages and serve as a sounding board to help them make sure. I'm not an attorney, so I don't provide legal advice, but I can share with them my 22 years of having been a volunteer and now staff with this organization, what we've learned as an organization in all that time. But Ken stated as well that the feedback he received from the people was so valuable to him in determining the marketability of his product. And he attributes so much to the MIC that he actually has the fact that he won a gold medal on each of his products that he distributes. And he is changing the packaging, the sheet of paper that's going around with it. He's learned some things he did wrong, and now there's a better picture on the packaging that will actually show how the product is used. If you've ever had to hang wallpaper or watch your wife hang wallpaper, this is where one person can do it because there's little pegs behind it and you stick it up on one end and you start at the other end and you roll it out and you just need a single person to do it. So it's been very well received and he's very excited about the potential. And he's very excited because this year he can come back and now sell his market-ready product in our gift shop at the MIC. So the last successful inventor story, has anybody seen Victor Toso's invention, the Nada chair? State fair, county fairs, anywhere you go, you see his cooler set up and his salespeople. 1986, Victor, he displayed this at the Inventors Congress. When I called him last spring, I was looking for him. I have kept in touch with Victor over the years, which I have with many of the inventors that we work with, just to see where he was at. Well, I ended up talking to him in Denmark. He was opening up his European division for the Nada chair. And clearly has the true invention story of understanding that coming up with the idea is the easiest part of this whole process. The work that comes into play afterwards is where the challenges begin. But he said that he's coming back this year to our 50th event with a product that he claims is going to be much easier to market in the United States. And so he'll be bringing his. And he's just always used us as a sounding board and a referral source to help find reliable resources across the country to work with. And that's what we do, is help educate people on how to use the reliable resources, not the invention promotion scam companies that target inventors.
Well, I think you have a very successful operation and well-known, and you're in the base, I believe. And so if there are no questions, Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's exciting to go to the Inventors Congress, and I invite you to come way down south and give me a call, and I'll meet you there.
Because you
I heard they got a machine that can make me 6 feet tall, so I'm going
to... Well, if they got one, I could probably make me a little thinner, maybe, huh? But anyway, I think it's kind of exciting to see rows and rows of inventors there. And the thing that's even more exciting is there's a Children's Inventors Congress that we started also, and I think there's where you really see the enthusiasm. And if you see the payback to a state, I can't think of a better place you'll see it than there.
Okay, Representative Clark.
I have a quick question. Do you help people get their prototypes funded? Because that's, I mean, I've talked to many people who have lots of ideas, and the thing is coming up with the money to do the prototype, and I don't know if that's in this budget or not, or it's in what you do.
Ms. Hess?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, the saddest message I have to deliver is there's no free money. There's nobody out there willing to pay people for their ideas or for their prototype. What we do is try to educate them. There are so many great resources that are written about how to help them make the decisions and how to get the information so that if they do form a business and can help raise funds, that that's a possibility. But we don't have any grants or funding that we give back. Our operating budget specifically is my staff time, or my salary, rent, utilities, promotions, dollars that we use. And for the reason for the additional request, clearly, I think you can see by the numbers that we deal with, if I'm not in the office, it's just to even give me a half-time person to cover when I'm gone at the schools or making a presentation. You know, there's nobody in the office today.
Mr. Chairman, just the last thing. I mean, you have I know somewhere, watch out for scams. I've seen them on TV. You don't send us your ideas. I presume they're scams. So, I mean, people who have genuine ideas who maybe, you know, they just need someone to help them put the product together. They don't have the resources to do that. I guess we're not in that business, but it seems like, you know, it's too bad because I think what's happened now, there is a whole new thing where people are scamming folks with their ideas and probably not, they don't get anything back for it.
Sadly, I deal with people, Mr. Chair, every day. I just dealt with a 22-year-old from Hugo, Minnesota, who had just signed a $16,000 contract with a business. I just talked to a gentleman yesterday morning who has a $12,000 contract. We're actually working with them to try to get their money back. These scam companies, I could take another whole session and explain to you.
Well, we have to move on because we've got another bill. Representative Welk, your pressing question.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. As a participant in the Minnesota Student Inventors Fair in Congress, I just want to say that the event at Redwood Falls is well attended, and it's a worthwhile event, and I just encourage you to continue doing what you're doing.
I think you do a great job, Representative Becker.
And just real quickly, Mr. Chairman, there are people there that will help patent the products that people invent. There are people there that will guide and do some direction as far as funding them. Certainly, everyone here has probably had an idea that could have led to a fortune for them, but we never had enough guts to pursue it.
Okay, with that, Representative Detmer renews his motion that House File 519 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. No further questions. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Representative Mahoney, back to the drawing board. And Representative Mr. Nelson, if there were no further questions, we have an amendment. Amendment number 8051, Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the HDA 051 amendment to House File 648. Specifically, this is for Ainsworth employees in Bemidji, Cook, and Grand Rapids. There are many of these employees who are still receiving unemployment benefits, but their benefits are set to expire within the next 30 days. 16 to 20 in Cook, 30 in Bemidji, and almost 60 still in Grand Rapids, regardless of whether those plants come online again or not. And specific to these employees, these are well-trained, dedicated employees that are being recruited away from our communities, moving to other places. And we need the time to train them and integrate them back into our workforce so we can keep them in our communities as active, productive members of our community. So I would encourage
committee members support and answer any questions you might have.
Questions on the 051 amendment? Comments? Representative Moore again?
Yeah, just, Mr. Chairman, sorry, just to be clear too, this extends our unemployment benefits for 15 years.
Okay, Mr. Nelson. Any comment?
Mr. Chairman, I have no comment.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moog, I'm just wondering if that's the total impact of the bill. I've been trying to read it really quickly, and is it just extending unemployment benefits as they were currently receiving them for 13 weeks, and that is the impact of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Briner, yes, that is the intent of that is the bill.
Mr. Members,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I think it's a great idea, and I'd like to accept it as a friendly amendment.
Representative Mahoney incorporates the amendment then into the bill, which
Mr.
I
Chair,
is legal.
I have another amendment to this particular bill. It's the 0179.
Okay.
Might be a little tougher than Representative Moe's.
Representative Mahoney offers the 179 amendment. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, many states at this particular point in time do not count severance packages, separation packages against their unemployment. This is a late entry into this particular bill. I'll just read it. This clause does not apply to the first $25,000 of any amount of severance pay, bonus pay, sick pay, or any other money payments paid by an employer because of, upon, or after separation of employment. If it could be done in many other states, it can be done in this state. It has a substantial fiscal impact, so there will be more conversations about this amendment, but I think it's an appropriate place to put it on and have the conversation here or and as it goes forward.
Mr. Nelson, would you care to comment on this one?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I have a handout if I can have that handout.
Anders or Nina, would you grab the handout there and pass that around? Go ahead, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, well, don't wish to speak against the sponsor of our bill. I'm going to have to in this particular instance. Well, he is correct. There are a minority of states which do not deduct severance pay. The vast majority do, in fact, deduct severance pay from unemployment benefits. I shouldn't use the word deduct. When you receive severance pay, it simply delays the onset when unemployment benefits are available. It doesn't reduce the amount of unemployment benefits that may be available to you. So if you get 10 weeks of severance, you could simply start collecting unemployment benefits after those 10 weeks if you are still unemployed. If you have a 26-week entitlement, you would then collect those 26 weeks after that if you are still unemployed. So it simply delays the onset of unemployment benefits. Being passed out is a cost. If this had been in place in 2005, it would have cost $36,426,608. Currently, there are about 12,700 denials of benefits because of severance pay currently. And again, that's a delay. You don't reduce the benefit entitlement, you simply delay the onset. Had this been in place back in 2002, as you can see, we did 22,800 in 2001, 23,000 denials or delays, if you will. This would have impacted well in excess of $50 million had it been in place back in 2001 and 2002. This is about a 6% increase in overall benefits. Again, last year, about $680 million, I believe I testified to a few weeks ago, before Representative Adkins' committee, on benefits paid last year, $680 million. This would increase those by about 6%. Correspondingly, when you have a benefit increase what it means is a tax increase for employers. Employers will pay additional taxes because someone has to pick up the tab. Someone's got to pay for this. We believe that this bill, if it has merit, it should be discussed with all the various interest groups. We only became aware of this bill last night at about 5 o'clock. We think it should be discussed and a consensus reached with all interest groups. There are arguments to be made for this bill. There are arguments to be made against this bill. But we believe that the cost should cause this committee some cause for concern. And we believe that this is not a proper vehicle. Again, the unemployment insurance bill, you know, passed without amendment last year in the Senate. All unanimous committees, there were no amendments last year of any substance, only technical amendments last year, and got hung up on the floor. But this year we're adding some amendments in the field. Especially this one is improper given its size and scope. The Ainsworth Amendment is relatively minor. I could speak to the cost of that if somebody would like that. But this is a substantial thing, and this is an ongoing cost year after year.
Well, members, let's take those concerns one at a time. First of all, you know, I want to emphasize here that this money would not, any increase would not be counted against the target of this committee because it's a special fund from the Unemployment Compensation Fund. Number two, there are 13 states that have no offset. This is a state law. I don't know when it was implemented, but there are also 21 states that have a partial offset, Mr. Nelson, and this is capped, so it's a partial offset. I support the Mahoney Amendment for a reason. Specifically, you know, a lot of members of, let's say, the United Auto Workers, as an example, in the St. Paul plant, don't qualify or haven't qualified for unemployment compensation because of the seventh package that their union negotiated. And good for their union. That's what having a union and union protection is all about. And I think it's unfortunate that a lot of the workers in this state who have negotiated, whether through their union collectively or individually, a severance package with their company, that they have to spend it down when they get laid off. What we're doing here with this amendment, Mr. Nelson, is not, you know, we're not breaking new ground here nationally, as I said, because if you count the partial offsets in other states, about 40 or 35 states have this in their law. So I would support the Mahoney Amendment. I think it's a discussion that needs to take place, and I understand that, you know, that there was a compromise worked out with this particular bill, but obviously something happened to the process last year when no amendments were offered because the bill never got off the House floor. So I think the discussion should be had, and perhaps after this discussion is had on this severance issue, this may come out of this bill. But at this time, I would hope the committee would support Representative Mahoney. So with that, Representative Stevenson, did you have a question on the end?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple of questions. First, on the First Amendment, I wonder if there is a fiscal note, and Mr. Nelson could address that. And then I've got a follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Representative Stevenson, I think my numbers showed when we were looking at this bill that if everybody took advantage of it, which we don't think they will because we've been told the cook workers are going to go back to work, but you don't know if that's going to happen or not. But if every Ainsworth employee took advantage of it, I think it's $440,000. Mr. Nelson, am I off base?
Mr. Chairman, that was the $432,000 figure was the Senate version. The amendment offered here is a little bit different, I believe, my members would say. About $600,000 one-time cost, about $600,000, and that's you're absolutely right, Mr. Chairman. That's if everybody who would be entitled under that would collect. That excludes almost all the cook workers, however. That does include 16 cook workers who will not be returning should that plant open on March 19th, I believe is the date. But with all extensions, not 100% of all the workers covered by the extension ever receive it. I should do point out by this extension also requires that they be in training, so it does provide a limitation. But the maximum cost of this, that particular amendment would be a little over $600,000, one-time cost.
Okay, and Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to the second amendment, and since Representative Mahoney is taking this on as a friendly, you know, I guess my concerns here are, you know, this is a separate bill that we're talking about, tagging on to an agency bill, and I think one of the issues that needs to be brought out is the reason that this was not brought to the House floor last session was because it was a Christmas tree. It was basically one of those things that this amendment would have been brought to the House floor, and then it would have been debated extensively and probably stopped government. I think there, this is a huge policy shift. This is a tremendous increase in the numbers that we are asking our employers to come to the table with. And it's going to have an impact on their companies economically. And we've just come out of the red in this unemployment insurance issue after paying the state back, you know, 6% on the dollar. And so to kind of jump into this thing without some, and I guess I would just, you know, ask it, being in the minority status, if we would have had this that we could actually prepare beforehand before we brought this to the committee to actually say, let's take a look at this process. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I think to throw it on as an amendment here onto an agency bill, we're just kind of short-circuiting the system. Part of our process here is to, in the committee process, is have an open and frank discussion on the pluses and negatives of the bill and allow us to do some preparatory work for that. So, you know, Mr. Chair, I understand the implications, you know, in this particular area are going to be extensive, and I would hope that we could properly address it in a committee hearing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson, we are addressing it right now in the committee hearing. Representative Mahoney.
Two things here to Representative Stevenson's concerns. This bill didn't get on the House floor last year because of an issue with apprenticeship, and it was very straightforward. I mean, there was some apprenticeship language laying out there for whatever reason, and it was going to get attached to this and wasn't going to go forward. The other part to your question about fully vetting this particular issue is it's going to get vetted because I got to get it passed from the floor. Gives you at least a week or a month or whatever to get prepared to ask me all sorts of good questions underneath the full glare of cameras.
Mr. and Representative Stevenson, this bill is being re-referred to Representative Murphy's committee, and then from Representative Murphy's committee, it goes to Representative Lynn Carlson's committee. And then from there, I don't know if it has to go to Ways and Means, but maybe my committee administrator can confirm that. And Mr. our fiscal analyst is saying probably. So it's got three more stops before it gets to the floor. So
I just thought I'd jump on the bandwagon early there. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the... you know, bringing it forward here, and I think, you know, one of the things I'm sorry, here he comes, I was just going to say, I'm sorry that Ms. Representative Gunther isn't here to kind of address this issue, too, because I've got some corporate history on this. And
yeah, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Are unemployment benefit rates determined by each state? Are the benefit rates determined by each state? I mean, so that some have a much higher rate that they pay versus other states that might have a lower rate that they pay for unemployment benefits?
Mr. Nelson, answer that particular question. I'll make sure I know the answer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't mean each state. Each state sets its own benefit levels, its own tax rates, all of those things. So there's no uniformity across the states. In fact, the states have get into a long discussion of how they even figure out tax rates. In Minnesota, which has been the state since 1937, the commencement of the program, all employers' rates, all for-profit businesses, pay an experience rating. Which means they pay higher taxes if they have a history of layoffs or responsibility for unemployment. They pay higher rates than do employers who do not have any history of layoffs. And all employers pay a base rate. And the base rate is triggered by the level in the trust fund. And right now, because the trust fund is relatively low, those base rates are at the highest levels set by statute. But then on top of that, employers pay an experience rating, and that's combined with a total tax rate. Minnesota is the highest, the most experience-rated state in the nation, meaning we charge those employers who create unemployment more than most states. Most states, if you notice, they spread the cost among all employers. We try to add the cost to those who create the problem, if you will, more than most states. But I should tell you, to give you an example, there are 7,000 of the 125,000 employers in Minnesota who are at the maximum tax rates. They do not pay their share, and the rest of employers subsidize them, if you want to use that term, to the tune of about $150 million a year. So there are a lot of employers who don't pay their share, and all the rest of employers have to pay that. So, but it is experience rated, and like I say, Minnesota is the most experience rated state in the nation. We charge those employers who create the problem more than most states.
Representative,
yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the benefits that we pay out to laid off workers then are where do they fall as compared to other states? I guess what I'm getting at is it's the issue of looking at this amendment becomes more complicated, I think, in the respect of what are we already paying out for benefits as it compares to other states. If we're going to compare some other states allow this benefit but they pay significantly lower rates out up front, I mean, I guess I think there's issues there we should talk about.
Is that it?
Mr. Chairman, it's representative. It's every state. The standard across the nation has been since the start of the program is to try to provide 50% of an individual's average weekly wage, and that's the theory. You don't want to provide too much because there's a disincentive to get another job, but you want to provide enough so that can meet their most basic needs. But Minnesota does provide a higher benefit level. Our average unemployment benefit rates, I believe the last I looked, were fourth or fifth highest in the nation. But that's a little bit of a misnomer because the average individual in Minnesota earns more than they do in most states. So, you know, do we have the highest benefit levels in the nation? No, we do not. We are towards the maximum. But again, we're towards the maximum in average wages, so we will be there. I'll just give you an example. The maximum benefit amount in Wisconsin is $359. The maximum benefit level in Minnesota is $521. So every state is different. Some states are very, very low. South Dakota is just something over $200. So the benefit levels are vary throughout the nation. It's hard to compare states. But you have to compare them in relation to what the wage levels are in those states.
Okay. Representative Norton, would you move the minutes of the March 1st meeting?
Far less controversial. I'd be happy to move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Norton. All those, if there are no additions, if they're correct, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Norton.
Chair Rukavina and others, Representative Mahoney, I'm struggling with this a little bit because this is an area, as a new representative, I haven't had a lot of time and experience with. And so to deal with an agency bill, even though I'm not familiar, is easier to do, but to make a significant change in an agency bill in something I have not yet had time to study is making me a little nervous. So I'm either looking for reassurances that the next committees will deal with this and have more knowledge than I do on this subject, or I'm feeling uncomfortable voting yes for it. And so I'm just looking, I guess, for some assistance either from the presenter or the chair. Some counsel, please.
Representative Norton, I don't want to pretend I'm counsel or a counselor, but I'm not an attorney. I can assure you of this. There are many department bills that have been amended in committee, and your job as a legislator is to make laws. And so, you know, you sometimes have amendments that are put up by members, and
that you have one right here. That's, I think, a good amendment, and I would hope that as a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party on this, you could give us a vote on this, and we could move this on to Representative Murphy's committee, where it will be looked at again. How is that for a council?
That's not exactly what I have.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could just...
Representative Mahoney,
I could just add on. I mean,
care to add your hourly charge to that? Go ahead.
You know, as we work through many things here in this particular committee that affect everyone's district, you as the chair of this particular committee have a lot of power to help all sorts of members, and this is just and constituents, and this is just one way of helping a member or a constituent.
Representative Gunter, did you
on the list? Sarah Spina.
Representative Norton, you're still.
Could I? Dangerously continue. Oh boy.
When you dug a hole, yes. Representative Norton, when you've dug a hole, you might want to put the shovel down.
Yeah. I just want to point out that, in my defense,
you have no need to defend yourself. You're okay.
When an amendment
valued
comes,
and
thank you. I appreciate that. When an amendment comes to the table and a representative who's new to the area has not even had a time to review the amendment enough to know what to research so that they understand what they're voting on, again, I would just say I understand the pressure that you're putting upon me, but I do not feel qualified at this moment to vote on this issue.
Representative Norton, as we put our main bill together in a few weeks, I'm sure you're going to see all kinds of amendments flying around here. And you're going to have to make some quick decisions on your feet, and you're going to have to go with your heart as often as your head. Now, this amendment is very straightforward, and we've heard what the potential cost could be. You know, it's out there for discussion. It would not be unique to this state. In fact, this was only put on unemployment insurance, this restriction, I believe about a decade ago, in return for some higher benefit increases. This amendment was put on, and I think it was ill thought out at the time, but that's the basic history of it. You know, you can never go wrong voting with the chair. Representative Welty.
That's a quote.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, and to the either of the testifiers on the bill, is there a way that you could possibly provide me with an estimate as to the increase in the rates for the employers and what they're going to pay? And I know you addressed this earlier by saying that there was a difference between those because of the average or the expectancy that they're going to end up laying off with their given history, they may pay a higher rate. But can you at all provide me with an indication as to what the rate increase is going to be for the average business?
Mr. Nelson, I don't know if you can do that, but go ahead and try.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it doesn't exactly work that way because you're only talking about rates will increase, again, the base rate, which everybody pays and they pay an experience rating, is currently at the statutory maximum. So that is not going to increase your average employer. It's only those who would lay someone off and provide them a severance. Their rates would increase because that individual will, in fact, receive more unemployment benefits than they do now. As this handout shows, currently an individual who receives severance collects after the severance has delayed the onset, still collects 13.8 weeks of unemployment benefits. What this means is that those individuals will receive another 12 weeks of unemployment benefits. So it's only those companies which, in fact, have a layoff, provide a severance package, their rates will increase. Now, how much? That depends on the size of the employer. You know, a really large employer, let's say 3M's or something, that's a whole lot different than a small employer. Small employers' rates could jump dramatically because the large employer is not going to have that much impact. I mean, it's spread, because you spread it among thousands and thousands. Employers are taxed on their it gets complicated, but a portion of their payroll in a large employer, it depends on how many and how much severance and all that. So it's not just this is going to equate. What you can take it is that a benefit increase will result in employers paying in, because if the fund pays out the benefit, the taxes increase enough to replenish the fund. So if the fund pays out an additional $36 million a year, rates are going to increase enough so that that fund is replenished. It will be spread across those employers who have layoffs and provide a severance. If you can't pick any individual, I can't say this is how much rates will increase enough.
You can't predict it.
$36 million.
And the fund fluctuates, members, as Mr. Nelson testified here last week when Deed was in front of this committee, depending on how far the fund goes down and then the rate kicks in. So that same formula would be in place if this amendment goes on and then the severance does affect, but your numbers may not be accurate, it's your best estimate.
Too. Well, Mr. Chairman, these numbers are based on what would actually occurred had this been in place in 2005. Now, what will happen in 2007? How many employers will have layoffs? How many employers will provide severance? We don't know. If this bill had been in place back in 2001, it would have been substantially higher than the $36 million.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know where to start, but I'll start with this. Representative Norton probably did the right thing. She left. I really believe that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like a roll call on this amendment.
Being requested.
And I'd also like to point out to Representative Mahoney that severance is generally at the courtesy and probably guilt somewhat of an employer. And I have a feeling that that employer will probably not give as much severance pay in the future if we have this here, as well as sick pay and so forth, because they're going to have to count it twice. You know, after all these things are taken into account, then if the employee still doesn't have a job, then this UI does kick in and they get money for a longer period of time. However, if your amendment passes, I think for every action there's a reaction. The reaction will be we simply won't see as much severance pay, sick pay, and so forth given by the employer in the future. And I think this is kind of a travesty. How much will this cost? We don't know until we figure it out. Who pays for it? Certainly the employers around the state will all pay for it. We not only pay for it when the system runs out of money, we pay the federal government interest. And I really think Minnesota's had the most extensions of any state in the nation. Mm-hmm. In fact, we've had more extensions than all the other states put together. Now, I think one of them happened to one of your mines that happened got
several,
2.5 years?
Several of them did.
2.5 years you got?
No.
1.5?
No.
26, 50?
I think the LTV extension was for 6 months, but I could be off.
Mr. Nelson, how much was it for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, the state extension for LTV was 26 weeks. In addition to that, there was a federal extension.
That's 6 months where I come from.
And the state extension was 6 months. And then, but there were other, there was a federal extension on there, and there was a TAA benefits provided. So,
well, members, Representative Gunther, as Representative Norton left, and then she came back, but you were gone when we answered all of these questions. But we've got Representative Detmer and Representative Severson, and we're 10 minutes over our time period, so we'll just temporarily House File 648 on the table. And we are going to apologize to the Department of Labor and Industry because we didn't get to them. And tomorrow, members, you have a handout about the Ministry of Technology request from Mr. Berg because the committee had asked for it. And tomorrow, I think we'll try to take the Department of Labor, except I think tomorrow is still
there. Yeah, but
local. Are they mostly local office? Excuse me for 1 minute, your members, before we adjourn.
Mr. Chair?
Do you have a sense of when you might be bringing this bill back up off the table?
As soon as doctor starts cooperating. Other than that, we'll try to get it up as soon as we can. And what I'm trying to find out here is when we can take Department of Labor and Industry. So what we'll do, if Mr. Commissioner, you have somebody contact my office later, and we'll see if we're going to take you right away at the beginning. I don't want to, if there are people that came from a long way out of town, I don't want to delay their testimony. But we'll fit you in tomorrow, obviously. And Representative Mahoney, we'll try to schedule this bill before the end of the week or early next week if we can fit it in. With that, members, we'll see you tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.